This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism, hashtag podcast, hashtag broad on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Broad on Joy 94.9.
Hey, welcome to Broad on Joy 94.9. Thanks to Well. Here we are. It is Monday, August the 29th. We're almost there. September is coming very soon. And I want to welcome you to the show. Of course, Broad would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands that we broadcast from, the Kulin Nation, of course, and pay respect to all Kulin elders, women from the past, present, and those women who will be our future elders. We'd also like to acknowledge with respect the traditional owners of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lands that we broadcast to, and pay respect to all elders and women elders from all clans and nations, past, present, and future. Welcome to Broad. And welcome, of course, Jackie's back again.
Back again. Hello.
Yeah. Because it's been quite a successful, overwhelming, fascinating, interesting, intriguing and challenging weekend.
It was. For the Feminist Writers Festival.
Yes. Now, you probably have noticed if you do follow Broad on Facebook, it's been going a bit crazy with the amount of podcasts of some of the panels and everything. Because it has been, very busy, and there were some great panels over the weekend. We'll be discussing that and a bit more. There'll be some broad news as well. And that was TLC, of course, No Scrubs. I'm very excited because I'm a fan, maybe not as monstrous a fan as I would like to be, but they are coming to Melbourne in November, I believe. How excitement is that?
Yeah, that's enough time for you to become a monstrous fan, I think.
Yeah, I don't think it'll take much, really. Not really. But yes, so there's a whole bunch of sound bites that we have got for the Feminist Writers Festival and some highlights there too. Oh, so Jackie, I mean, started on Friday, what was it called? The Network Day?
The Networking Day on Friday. So I rocked up at 8 a.m., which is early for me. I normally do later at night. So that was cool. And just met so many really cool people. There were some amazing panels, just loads and loads of really fantastic women, especially. It's always really nice to get into a room and it's just like full of women and, you know, people who aren't men. And it was just really
people who aren't men.
You know,
there's more
genders out there. There are a few men.
And there were babies. Not man babies, but actual babies who were male. So it was cute.
Yeah.
So we've got news for feminists coming up. We'll play some of those highlights, talk about the festival and the outcome of that and how it's going. Melbourne Writers Festival's on currently at the moment. So there was a bit of a crossover as well for some of the speakers and panels that were involved there. And also, look, if you have or if you were at the Feminist Writers Festival, let us know. What panels did you go to? Maybe we saw you, maybe we didn't. 0427 Joy 949, or you can phone us 1300 Joy 949. Roberta is at the reception, or on air at joy.org.au to email us. Ah, Twitter. That's right. We got Twitter. Tweety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you can tweet us. Which is at BroadFem949, I think.
That's the one.
I got it right after all these years, finally. So look, let's have a bit of a soundbite. There's one here that I think would be quite interesting. And this is, I think it's a, what is feminist writing? That's a taker, ear gander, if that's the word, ear gander.
That's a great word.
I made that up. I'm sure someone else has had it before. But here we are on Broad on Joy 94.9.
Hi, everyone. It's really great to be here at this festival today. So I reckon we should start by kind of tackling the question head on. I mean, the name of this session is What is Feminist Writing? This is the Feminist Writers Festival. When I started thinking about this question, to me, I thought, well, there's certain writing that is obviously feminist writing. It's activist writing. It has clear feminist aims. It's written for a really specific purpose. I think we all know what that is when we see it. But I also think everyone here understands that feminist writing is obviously much, much broader than that. And that's the kind of things I want to talk about today, because I realised for myself I don't have an easy definition. I don't have an easy answer to this question. Thinking as a reader first before a writer, some of the moments that have most opened up my feminist consciousness or really changed the way I think about gender and sex and myself and my place in the world have been reading things that are not self-consciously feminist. One thing that's always struck with me was reading the novel The Long Prospect by Elizabeth Harrower, which is a novel set sort of around the Newcastle suburbs in the 1950s, and the main character is this working class adolescent girl, and it just took her so seriously as an intellect, as someone with an inner life. And that is like a hugely profound kind of breakthrough moment for me when I was still quite young, of realising that the lives of a young working class girl might be worth taking seriously and might be worth talking about. So, you know, I can come up with loads of examples like that in literature, and I have no idea if Elizabeth Harrow identifies as feminist. I'm pretty sure she didn't write that as a specifically feminist novel. But there's so much writing that can have that kind of perhaps unintended effect on us. So what is meant by feminist writing?
I come from the 1970s feminism, have been around for a long time. I'm now 72. I still consider myself, as I was introduced, as a radical lesbian feminist. And as somebody who's been writing for a long, long time, I consider my writing is a reflection of my feminist values, the framework by which I try and live my life as a feminist and as a lesbian. Both of these have had to be learned. And so one of the biggest moments of my life was when I went to my first consciousness raising group in 1972. And none of us really knew what we were doing there or how we were going to do it. We were just making it up as we went along. I was at that stage, I just went back to study. I left school at 16, so I went back to study when my children went back to school. And a lot of the people I knew thought this was rather crazy. What was I doing studying? So here I was in this group and people were saying, yeah, that's fine, you ride a motorbike, you're studying at La Trobe Uni, isn't that a good thing? And so from there we started to develop, and this is where a lot of the feminist theory came from the consciousness raising groups of the 70s, where we talked about our lives and our first periods, what was happening when we got our first period, how were we brought up differently to our brothers, what were our mothers' lives like, did we want to live the kind of life that our mothers had been living, all of those kinds of things that had never been questioned before. With the women's liberation movement, it was a really big lifesaver for women like myself, that we were suddenly questioning every aspect of our lives. But we weren't doing it in isolation. I think that was one of the most exciting aspects of feminism, that we were doing it in groups, that we were doing it with other like-minded feminists. And then, of course, I was able to come out in the late 70s and embraced being a lesbian feminist. And I think that has informed my life as well as my writing a great deal. Yes, I can't imagine writing without being a lesbian feminist. And I was writing the kind of books that I wanted to read.
Thank you, Jean. Just thinking about, with the question about what is feminist writing, how do I define feminist writing? For me, as being someone, as a woman of colour, as an Asian Australian woman, that I arrived in Australia in the 1990s, 1991. I was 14 years old. As a newly arrived migrant, I struggled to find my identity, so my place. And so I just began writing my journals. And it was a way of understanding myself, my body, my sense of who I was in the world, my sexuality. And, you know, these journals, kind of writing became became a monologue. And I was able to kind of present it in a public forum because it won a short play competition. And I had a play reading at the Victorian Arts Centre. I guess for me that was a big deal because it was about coming out. It was being, you know, being a woman of colour, talking about racism. And that was a way of writing myself into being. And for me that was a kind of a feminist thing to do.
From Australia and around the globe, this is the Broadcast News.
Ah, yes, Broad here on Joy 94.9. The news, well, sort of. Let's see how we go. An upcoming homeless shelter serving LGBTIQ youth in New York City is hoping to give dozens of queer people a warm place to stay. And that's thanks to the late Golden Girls star Bea Arthur. A staggering 40% apparently of homeless youth are served by agencies that identify as queer every day, and that's according to the Williams Institute in New York. And that's from a report of thegailygrind.com. So yes, how amazing. Though the shelter was initially scheduled to open this summer, that's obviously in the Northern Hemisphere, construction on the long derelict building being gut renovated by builders and construction workers has hit a few snags after breaking ground in July of last year. There were a few Department of Building violations stacked up against the rundown site from the start, but it seems that everything is resolved now. And though the holdups have placed the renovation work several months behind schedule, the project is now well underway, becoming a shelter that will provide beds, on-site counselling and case management to the city's homeless, queer and transgender youth. So it's $3.3 million that the city have funded for this project, and it bears the name of the Broadway and television actress Bea Arthur, who, of course, was a great supporter and defender of queer rights, cheerleader, you could say. Bea Arthur, who'd put the benefit show was struggling as a non-for-profit from 2005. She bequeathed $300,000 to the centre upon her passing in 2009. Thank you for being a friend, Bea, if you like the Golden Girls. Are you a fan of the Golden Girls, Jackie?
I've never watched it, but now I feel like
goodness.
I have to.
You're kidding.
I kind of missed out on that, you know.
That's okay. There's about 15 seasons.
Oh, wow.
You've got some work there.
I'll get there.
Okay. Cox, not Glocks. Texas students are carrying dildos on campus to protest gun laws over there. That has been released. That was news from Wednesday just gone. So last Wednesday, Cox, not Glocks protest against Texas campus's carry law. And what that means is that basically it's a resistance that's been spearheaded by some of the classes at the University of Texas in Austin, from students and faculty members at the college in general. And the rally took place along a tree-lined avenue beneath the tower at the heart of the campus where Charles Whitman, a psychopath, embarked on a shooting spree on August the 1st in 1966, so almost 50 years ago. Well, actually, over 50 years now. Terrible, and he targeted women because apparently no woman would go out with him. There you go. An absolute psycho. He has gone, thankfully. Now, this new law about carrying guns passed last year by Texas Republican-dominated legislature. Can't say that right. It came into effect on the 50th anniversary of the massacre. That's very poor taste. And it permits licensed gun owners aged 21 and older to carry concealed handguns in the most public places on university campuses, including dorms and classrooms. Okay, so demonstrators are gathered to brandish sex toys, which are actually banned at the campus. So, of course, hence the name Cox, not Glocks. Now, they carry them, strap them to themselves, their backpacks and other places, saying, "We have crazy laws here, but this is by far the craziest, that you can't bring a dildo onto the campus legally, but you can bring your gun. We're just trying to fight the absurdity with absurdity." And that's Rosie Zander, a 20-year-old history student. Well done. What do you think about that?
Oh, it's a bit Jackie. Terrifying that you can just, like, bring a deadly weapon into your school.
And not
your
a
school.
Deadly dildo. Not deadly, but, you know. I have seen,
like,
a movie
harmless...
where people were killed by dildos.
Well,
it was a horror film.
Less harmless.
Death orgasm. No, not death orgasm. Deathgasm.
I think one of the sound bites that's kind of coming up starts with a Margaret Atwood quote that's pretty relevant here. Women are scared that men are going to kill them. Men are scared that women are going to laugh at them. And
with a dildo.
I think this illustrates that pretty well.
It is a mad, mad world, and that's in the United States at the moment. Other news that's much more positive and happening in the continent of Africa is female chief has terminated 850 child marriages in Malawi and is sending girls back to school. Fantastic. A Malawian female chief has established a new law to prevent child marriage in Malawi and has terminated, like I said, around 850 child marriages across the country to date. So that's very exciting. Her name is Teresa Kachitamato. She's a senior chief in the Desda district of Malawi and claimed that her decision is to take a stand has come about from her frustration over seeing 12-year-old girls walking around with babies on their hips. That's just outrageous, and you know it's not fair on those girls, and many, many other reasons we support Teresa on the stand. So according to the 2012 United Nations survey, more than half of Malawi's girls are married before the age of 18. Wow. And in addition, the country is ranked 8th out of 20 countries believed to have the highest child marriage rates in the world. So Chief Kachitamato is changing this one step at a time and has begun by annulling more than 850 of these child marriages. It really sends a message out there to women and to young girls and to men that it's more important to establish those lives with an education first and giving them a chance to, yeah, have a life, basically.
Mm-hmm. I think cases like this make it really obvious why it's so important to have more women in government all over the world.
Yes.
Because these are the people who are going to be pushing really important legislation like this.
That's amazing. Oh, just incredible. Mm-hmm. And if you are living in Melbourne town, we've got the Queer Literary Salon. It is sold out, so maybe you know it's pointless mentioning this, but I just thought it looks fabulous. There's a great range of great speakers there. It's basically celebrating queer culture in a literary salon setting, combining revelation with revelry. Sounds good. The special guests include the wonderful Adolfo Arañez, Ivan Coyote, Amy Middleton, who will be in one of the little segments we've got soon, playing soon. I was going to say playing up. Of course, she's the editor-in-chief of Archer magazine. Bo Buck Sayed, Francesca Rendell Short, Rebecca Shaw, of course, and Lawrence LaCambra. Yi Pearl will be there being interviewed, doing readings, true tales, even live illustrations. That's pretty cool. Hosted by 3RRR, having that radio phone at the moment. And, yes, that's thanks to the Star Observer, got that. So you can go to viralwoman.com to find out more about that. But it is sold out. There might be standing room outside. I don't know. But maybe it just means we need more of these sorts of gatherings and salons.
Absolutely. It sounds amazing.
I think so. One more thing. Thanks to Gina from Outtakes. Applications are now open for a FINA project. They opened on the 3rd of August, runs through to the September the 8th is the closing. What is it? A FINA project is screen works that are addressing gender imbalance and creating increasing the number of regional women in lead creative roles in the Australian film and television industry. And the new project is a screen works initiative funded by Screen Australia through the Gender Matters Brilliant Careers Program. The aim of this program is to help female writers and directors from the regional parts of Australia to A, leverage initial success in the screen industry, in other words, get a foot in, build professional networks, in other words, get a foot in and get those networks and contacts and things going, and create viable career pathways, in other words, get a foot in, make those networks happen and hopefully get a job out of it. That's pretty much what I'm reading here. The FINA project includes two events that will be held at the Byron Resort in Byron Bay. There will be a public screening, but that's not till 8th of November, a two-day selective residential workshop. That's on the 9th of November and 10th of this year, and residential workshops, the participants will be able to get involved there and develop career plans, and it's very strategic. They are looking for more Indigenous women to get involved in that program, so we'll pop that on the Broad Facebook page for that FINA project. Looks fantastic. And you've got till September the 8th, which is the closing date for that, for those applications. Awesome. So what I think we'll play very soon in a very short time is a big chunky one. It's speaking of things like that, it is Feminism Through Narrative Nonfiction. I know it's the history one, and history does history?
It's just very, very cool.
Why is it important, Jackie? Is feminist history important?
Yeah, you've got to learn from the past. And I think women are constantly erased from mainstream history as it's taught to us. So I think feminist history is extremely interesting and important because it's like uncovering all these stories that the patriarchy has covered up for years. It definitely is.
Is that good?
Look, feminist revisionism is definitely a good important thing, you know.
They'll be talking about that soon. So that's coming up shortly. And we've got people like, well, we've got Liz Connor and Claire Wright involved in that. They're academics and they do write books. Pretty cool indeed. We'll have a listen to that shortly. You're listening to Broad. Don't forget, message us if you wish to, 0427JOY949 or email on air at joy.org.au. Bianca from The Girlfriedas, what does feminism mean to you?
Feminism for me is creating equality for all humans across the world, regardless of circumstance, and not keeping anyone down for whatever reason.
I am Sophie Hyde, and you're listening to Broad on Joy 94.9.
Claire Wright is a historian, author, and broadcaster. She's got a lot of books to her name, but in this discussion I'm going to be referring to her book, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka. Now, I do want to start off with a quote. It's a quote from Geoffrey Blainey from The Tyranny of Distance, 1966. The quote is, "Every history of every country is a mirror of the author's own interests, and therefore selective rather than comprehensive." Now, let's elaborate on that from a feminist perspective. Both of these ladies have written about early settler times in Australia. Claire, if I can start with you. Now, when we look at our past, history is often documented from the perspective of men and male achievements. But in your book, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, you look beyond the myth of the Australian goldfields as being an exclusively male domain. And most of us would know that the Eureka story is pretty legendary. But we don't hear about the Australian women. You wanted to tell the story about the women and their political legacy. How do you approach history as a feminist?
Well, I should say that quote, you guys, to give you some context about that Geoffrey Blainey quote, that's actually one of a couple of quotes that I used to start my book. And it's a bit cheeky because Geoffrey Blainey is obviously a very famous Australian historian. He's known as being a very conservative Australian historian. And he's often taken to be kind of the last word. And he's certainly written about Eureka in one of his most famous books, is The Rush That Never Ended, about mining in Australia. And he writes about Eureka in that. So to pull a quote out of Blainey that says all historians write selectively was, you know, my little thumbs up to the historical world, mainstream historical world as we know it. So that's just a bit of context for that. I suppose the thing about doing the Eureka Project is that, in terms of going about it as a feminist scholar, is that I think that it was really important to me, and I think that this is the crux of feminist scholarship, is that it's really important what questions you ask. You can't anticipate the answer, because then you're writing politically loaded, indeed politically directed, history. And I don't think that's good history. I think that might be polemic. It might be the good basis of a manifesto, but it doesn't make for good history. And what I mean by that is that what I did with that book was I set about with the question, which was, were there women at the Eureka Stockade? Because this is a story that has always been told as if only men were there. It's how I learnt about it in school, how all of us learnt about it in primary school, secondary school, how our kids still learn about it. I've got kids in primary school and in high school, and they've all learnt about the Eureka Stockade, and they still learn about it, well, until my book came out, as if there were there was the military versus the miners, and they had a battle on the frontier, and more miners than military got killed, and out of this we had the birth of democracy. But the picture of that, the way that that's taught, is that the only participants in this battle that made us who we are today were men. And that's implicit in the story. And I'd never thought to question that as a school child. I'd never thought to question it in my early years as an historian. But certain other work that I'd done, my PhD that led to my first book was about female publicans, about women in the hotel industry, another area that had been exclusively gendered male, and the assumptions that were made about that space. But then when I went back into the primary archive for my PhD and went and looked at the licensing records and looked at the, you know, the hard primary evidence, what actually came out of that was that more women than men ran pubs. And in the 19th and early 20th century, hotel keeping was decidedly a women's business. Mm-hmm. Women dominated that as a commercial industry. So armed with that kind of understanding, I went to the Eureka question, another space that has been, you know, a key Australian cultural and historical part of our narrative, and asked the question, were women there? I had an inkling that they might be. You know, that was the primary question. It's a very simple one, but a very disruptive one in its own way. And so it was by setting that question that, you know, were women there? If yes, how many? If no, why not? But if there were women, how many? Were there just a few? Well, that must have been an interesting life, but maybe there were more than that. And if there were quite a lot of women who were there, well, what were they doing? And what were they doing there? What did their lives look like? And did they participate in these political events that have constituted what it means to be an Australian in some kind of way? So it's that series of cascading questions that I think opens the space then to go into the archive, into the records, and find out what's there, to sweep away the mythology, the 150 years of people like Geoffrey Blainey and Geoffrey Searle and every major Australian male historian, and say, sweep away all of that and just build the story from the ground up. And lo and behold, it became a story about the women at Eureka because the women were there, because a third of the Ballarat population were women and children, because they were occupying every single space, economic, social, cultural and political, because women died at the Eureka stockade. And because of all of those things, everybody who was commentating at the time, writing letters, writing diaries, writing for newspapers, giving evidence to royal commissions, all of those people, most of the men, talked about the women because they were there. They were part of their daily lives. So I suppose that's a long way of saying, as a feminist historian, I think it's important to get to question the dominant narratives, but not go in necessarily thinking that you already know the answers. Because otherwise you're just picking up bits of evidence that establish a case that you want to build, as opposed to building up a picture of what the past looked like.
Liz, if you take the question, were women there, that Claire applied to her book, can that be applied to any historical event retrospectively?
I guess it goes back to Blainey's quote, doesn't it? And your cheeky misuse of it. Because he would say that it's individualists who, that it's individuals and their, you know, their selective interests that define the history that they do. But in fact, history is written by the victors, right? We know that. And so, therefore, it is the historical canon isn't just authored by men, but it's authored by white men, and particularly the victors of colonialism. And so there's another kind of layer to, you know, whether women were there or not, I think, and that is which women were there. Eureka was a frontier too. So, I mean, as you say, as you note in your book, Aboriginal women, you know, had this kind of fringe, relationship to this establishing urban entity. What I did with my book was something a little bit different in terms of building a case, because I'm an activist before I'm an academic, and all of my research is in service to I mean, in a similar way. I mean, you have a political intention to break apart these foundational national myths of manhood. And so I had a political intention to make the case that we are an especially nastily racist nation, unapologetically clear. And that's because, I mean, the genesis for my book was different. It was a bit similar in that I also was researching my PhD, Claire and I are close colleagues. The political intention for me was writing a book about flappers, right? I was writing about the camera and the way it changed the way women perceived themselves and were seen forever. Proximity, competition, beauty. So it was about visual identity and how visibility became an increasingly larger part of the wedge of identity for women. And while I was doing this research, mostly into 1920s newspapers and magazines, I found these incredible cartoons. And they were blood-curdlingly, eye-wateringly, hair-raisingly racist, these cartoons. I couldn't believe my eyes. And the striking thing was to me that this isn't part of our cultural knowledge and memory. And at first I just kind of went, oh, Jesus Christ. Some things are best left to history, and is it my place anyway as a white woman to recirculate this imagery? What if I'm just going to be calling up very hurtful memories for Aboriginal women, etc., etc.? But at the same time, I was very involved in the WIC activism and did a campaign called Stick With WIC, and we did the house plaques and the ribbons and the armbands, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was this kind of growing call from Andrew Bolt and Geoffrey Blaney, Black Armband History and the way the term was adopted. And I just thought, well, in fact, we do. I mean, I actually made these armbands and sold them to the body shop. We do have to adopt a Black Armband History. We're not going to have any chance of reconciliation if we don't know what that history is. Now, increasingly, there was this history of the massacres and the poisonings, but there was no, at that point, history of how the attitudinal base had to be in place for those things to happen. And given that print is, before radio, our principal medium for building shared understandings and consensus, I thought it was these cartoons, therefore, were very, very important. And I found a whole lot more, and then I started piecing together, well, what are the tropes for Aboriginal women around domesticity, maternity, sexuality? I quantified which were the dominant ones, and I put a tracery on each of them from Dampier right through to 1967. And what it revealed was blood-curdling. And so I did have a really strong political intention to build a case, but that's because, like you, when you had that aha moment with the licensing files, it was like it was just a jump-out thing. This is really a gap in history. This really could confront some of the narratives that are being constructed at the moment by the victors to serve their political purposes, and I want to disrupt that as an activist and with these skills as a researcher.
And in fact, in your book you talk about a sort of cultural amnesia when it comes particularly to the cruel treatment of Indigenous women.
Yeah.
How important do you think it is to sharpen our memory of, you know, women's place in history?
Mm.
And are there risks involved in doing that, do you think?
I guess women's place in history is marginal, and it's often incredibly cruel. And in the very first attempts by feminist history to find the notable women, they were often the marquise of blah, 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 or, you know, very well established, you know, or advantaged women who were able to be painters or writers. So we feminists went and found those women, but they weren't actually speaking to the experience of most women, and certainly not women who are really complete. Like they're virtually, you know, women who get a moment in the archives because they were part of a group that were rushed by men with guns and killed. We're never going to know their names. We don't know where their bones are. Like, this kind of absenting is so extreme. You're looking at it and thinking, what would happen if we could put the names to these women and find them? And the best we can do is really go to their descendants and say, well, what stories do you have? And la la la. But I think Claire's book's really evocative in that sense too, because you're talking about women who are really, this is real struggle town. And the way you evocatively write about, you know, so you can smell the dust, you can imagine them trying to, you know, manage and parent, you know, I'm not going to say parent, I hate that fucking word, mother, the children, with, because it's not true, right? With, this is a lie, with, you know, all their silhouettes being reflected on the tin. I mean, it's so evocative, but it's that thing about, it's not just notable women that feminists have to find. We actually have to speak to that the mass of women who were impoverished and doing it so hard in ways that we can barely imagine, right?
And I think for me as well, it's been about... I've been interested in finding the women who are going looking for the women and then fortunately finding them, who have been in places that have, as I said, been traditionally gendered male. So part of my... agenda, my feminist agenda, has been to build a case, in a sense, for the way that men and women have always shared space as well. Because I think that we've been, that feminist history in particular, from, you know, 1975, or, you know, really the, and it's been very shaped by the public-private sphere notion. And so the idea that if we're going to do women's history, we're going to go looking for women and we're going to go looking for women in the places where women are. But we still have assumptions about that. We're still holding assumptions about the places that women are, that they're not in the pubs and they're not on the gold fields. And so I think one of the things about looking for them in places that are shared spaces, you know, to me it's a little bit like Inga Clendinning's idea of dancing with strangers as well, looking for the ways in which there have been collaborations as well as conflict. And that's not shying away from conflict. I think that's incredibly important to document conflict and to document dissent and to document the various ways in which... people have performed acts of resistance, but I also think that you can go back to places that have been seen in a more rosy light and disrupt the narrative by it's not just adding, and I think this is a really important thing, that adding women to it doesn't just add colour to that narrative. It's like, oh, here's the gold fields that we knew, that we've been taught about in school. It's like an American-style Wild West and, you know, there's saloons and there's tumbleweeds blowing through town and you know, guns. And lo and behold, there's some women there as well. And isn't that a pretty scene? Actually, you know, or thinking or assuming, because we've got this Hollywood Wild West, that if there are women there, well, of course... they're whores, you know? They're either whores or they're the Deadwood, if you know, which is supposed to be revisionist television. They're still basically the whores and then the middle-class white woman peeking out from behind the curtain who's otherwise stoned to her eyeballs on whatever it is that she's sniffing. What is it? Laudanum.
If, please, thank Liz and Claire.
I'm Bryony Kidd, and you're listening to Broad on Joy 94.9.
This is Broad on Joy 94.9. We've had a lovely message, actually. Dear Sonia and friends, that includes, that's you, Jackie.
Hello.
My only friend left. I enjoy the show. Great to hear women's voices. Best wishes. Cheers, Jade. Thanks, Jade. I haven't heard from you for a while. That's awesome. Now, of course, we put on the Facebook page some of those links, Liz Connor and her book, Skin Deep. Now, just a warning about the book and the content of the article from New Matilda that I've put on the Broad Facebook page. It does contain images of those who are deceased of Indigenous background, and it does contain some very racist depictions from the 19th century and early 20th century. Pretty bad stuff. And there's a lot of things that we need to improve on to do with our relations here with country and, of course, with the First Nations, the Indigenous culture here. That's our opinion here on Broad and the opinion, I think, of the feminists that were on that particular panel, which was great. And that was the one about feminism through narrative nonfiction. The full podcast of that is already up on the Joy website for Broad. But next, we're going to listen to a nice sizable chunk as well of queer, transgender and feminist writing that was also on the Open Day or Network Day at the Feminist Writers Festival. You went to that one. I missed it, but yeah. At least you recorded it.
I was
good.
There, got recorded.
Yeah.
So that was with Alison Evans, Amy mm-hmm. Middleton, and Aliana Muhammad Ali. So they're all very, very cool.
They are very cool. Here's a bit of that. Again, if you want to hear the whole shebang, the whole thing, you can always check it out on the Broad Facebook page for the links, or go straight to joy.org.au, or go to Broad, I should say. I think it's broad/joy or something. Hey, you'll find it. Just use your search engines. And, yeah, we'll be wrapping up the show very soon. We're running out of time. Let's play a little bit of that. We may not get through all of it before we do say goodbye. And, yeah, goodbye, I guess.
Keep being feminist.
Keep being feminist. Next week, more stuff. More things are happening. We've got Rosemary Myers from Girl Asleep and some chat about Yoga Hosers. And, oh, these are films, by the way. I think they're feminist films. More of that next week on Broad. So let's listen to this interview to take us out for the evening. Thanks again to the Feminist Writers Festival and the Melbourne Writers Festival and to everyone who was involved. It was fabulous. The podcast of tonight's show with all the highlights for the Writers Fest will be up later this week. Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks, Sonia.
I know it goes fast, doesn't it? Here we go. This is Broad on Joy. Thanks for listening.
If you were new to feminist thinking, and perhaps if you are new to queer politics or queer communities, you might think that the two have quite a friendly history. But actually, it's not quite that simple. I guess I haven't really studied much academically about feminist history or queer history, but I do spend a lot of time in the community talking to individuals, particularly through my work with Archer magazine, which essentially collects the attitudes of people who are left out of mainstream media on topics around sex and gender. And feminism and queer politics kind of have a bit of a, I guess, interesting history and relationship. And I'd like to go into that today. I guess when we do talk about that tricky relationship, it's important to point out that there are a million different kinds of feminism. And I get the sense from being here for the last couple of hours that the brand of feminism that dominates in this room is a pretty friendly one. This festival has said that it's against hate speech and aggression, I think the wording is, which I think is a pretty good place to start any debate. And I'm certainly non-confrontational in my approach to everything. Pretty scared of fighting generally. But that said, I think it's important to look at the history of both those movements and where they've intersected and where possibly they haven't intersected all that smoothly. And before I ask my first question, I also want to mention that whatever we talk about, certainly on my behalf, is my own experience. Despite our diverse identities, which generally is the panel that we're on, agreed. We don't speak for all queer people, all trans people, all same-sex attracted folk, all lesbians, all women, all Muslim people, all people with freshly shaved heads, or any other group. We just speak from our own individual experience, and that's always up for discussion. So, to hand over to you two, as I mentioned, in terms of politics, feminists and gender diverse folk and sexually diverse folk don't always see eye to eye. Alison and Alina, in as far as you feel comfortable, I'd love to talk about how welcome you've felt in spaces that call themselves feminist in your lifetimes. I would probably say that I've felt pretty welcome, and particularly today I feel very, very safe, so that's good. Alison?
Okay. I guess spaces like this that are quite open and welcoming are quite good. It's sort of when you get to the more groups who are very stringent about definitions. I think that can be quite exclusionary. Like, is that near? Because, like, I'm non-binary, so I mean, a lot of the time I'm sort of left out of discussion anyway, which, you know, is what it is. But I don't know. There's sometimes I feel like it's a conscious effort to exclude people like us. And then, but I do find most of the time everyone is pretty welcoming and sort of, if they don't realize they're being exclusionary, then you can be like, hey, have you thought about this? And then people are generally like, oh, right, cool, great. So yeah, I think people are pretty flexible, which is nice.
Awesome. Yeah. Elena, do you want to add anything?
This is why I didn't go first. What I was going to say is my experience is that I came to Australia when I was about 3 years old, and I lived here till about 11, moved to Pakistan as what I thought as an Aussie kid, lived there till just before turning 20, and then came back to start university. And I went to Sydney Uni in 1997 for my first degree, and lots of things happened, and I was banned from the women's room. And one of the reasons I was banned from the women's room is because I didn't fit their idea of what a person of colour should be. I should be oppressed. I should have all these assumptions. This is in the 90s. And my family lived on the North Shore, and I grew up with every sort of opportunity available, made available to me. So I wasn't oppressed in my mind. I wasn't raised to believe I was oppressed. If we talked about education, which was really important in my family and in my world, my mother's mother went to university and was a practicing psychologist for many years before she married my granddad. So for me, then being told by the women in the women's space that I was this oppressed Pakistani woman, I really did not take kindly to that, and I felt that wasn't my space. So my space was the queer space.
It's interesting you mention getting kicked out of spaces at uni, because it's such a common, weirdly common experience. Like, I was sort of ostracized in no uncertain terms by the queer community at my uni when I started dating a boy. They were like, well, you're not queer enough for us, which would be fair if it was called the lesbian space, but it was called the queer space. And something to me felt pretty queer about going from girls to boys. I was like, check me out. This is, like, so diverse, right? Even though, yeah. So I guess the exclusionary side of things is something that I wanted to raise early on. And I want to talk about how things have changed. And Alina, I guess I'll start with you. You mentioned that that happened in the 90s. How are things now, do you reckon?
Well, I'm still going back to Sydney Uni's women's space. Still not going back there. Well, I can actually fast forward almost 10 years from then when I decided to go and do a master's at Monash. And it was a very different environment then. I came back as an older student, a mature age student. I already was working. And I decided I actually needed to study gender studies because I never had. Mm. And this was 2004, and a good 7 years later. And I'd been in the 90s loving queer politics and queer theory and everything queer, and I did date boys and girls and both at the same time, and that was all right in the queer circle I was in.
Well, lucky you.
I needed to come to Sydney.
My uni was in Sydney.
Wrong uni. But when I went to Monash Uni, it was really interesting, and I can't even remember the lecturer's name now, shame. But she was really good at challenging me on what I thought feminism was, because I would say again and again, I'm not a feminist. I'm not. And she would say, but you are. And we'd have this argument twice a week when I'd come to the university. And it took me actually finishing the degree and years later realizing that actually I am, but it was the label of that word and my experience growing up that made me believe that I am not a feminist.
What was it about the word that put you off, do you think?
My mother never used it. My father never used it. No one used it growing up. Mm. So when I only ever heard it, it was on Australian radio, and it meant hairy, man-hating lesbian. It was always a horrible, horrible word, and I didn't want to be a part of something that people mocked and hated. And so when I was fighting my sexuality and my spirituality, there was no way I was going to throw feminism into that as well. I was like, right, I've got enough struggles here. And my mum, who I think by every definition of the word feminist is a feminist and is an amazing feminist too, she wouldn't use that word to describe herself. And I had that conversation with her years later as to, you know, was it because of that man-hating, you know, stereotype, or was it that it just wasn't conscious? And it wasn't for her. Every woman needs to be questioning her state her position in the world. Every woman must have every opportunity. Every woman must be who she is. And so for her, it was just her existence, which was being feminist without actually using the definition.
It is true what Margaret Atwood said, that women are afraid that men will kill them, and men are afraid that women will laugh at them. And you can see that, you can see that being, you know, the amount of times that I've watched as, you know, the typical kind of a young white boy has gone on and on and on about how women can't take a joke, or black people can't take a joke, or we all just need to relax and be a little bit more like them, and just understand that everything's just a joke, you know, just calm down and relax. Lose their shit the moment you say anything about young white boys on the internet. I once posted a little image of a comment that said, "How is that racist - white people proverb?" And it had like 1,000 comments on it within a day, most of them from young white boys complaining about how I was racist, I was sexist, how dare I, you know, like abuse, threats, etc., etc. So for me now, my way of fighting back is just to broadcast them further. So anyone who says, well, you're afraid of, you know, you're silencing freedom of speech, I'm like, well, I'm not, because I'm sharing your words with more and more people. I'm giving you a bigger platform. You said that, you know, I'm just giving you extra eyes on it. Because they also don't want other people to see what they're saying. You know, that's why they always say, oh, I was hacked, or you know, people have said to me when I shared that image of the guy who wrote a comment on my, it was a public comment even. This was a private message that he sent to me calling me a lesbian slut, and he was going to come around to my house and rape me. Now, I don't actually believe that threat, you know, so it wasn't like I read it and I was scared, because I've read so many things like that that I have either, you can either consider it the luxury or the shielding of not being scared of that anymore. But I shared that, and people will say things like, well, I'm not saying that this is okay that he said this, but you're just as bad, if not worse, for sharing it. See, this is a lynch mob, you know. So they don't want, they want to be able to say whatever they want to you and have you just suck it up and be silent and scared. And because I refuse to do that, it makes them angrier and angrier. But someone very wise said to me once that it's not always about the people you're having the conversation with, it's the people who are listening. So when I take someone's comment and share it with other people, whether or not I'm doing it to make fun of them or whether or not I'm doing it to be more serious and say this is the consequence of being any kind of activist who sits outside of the dominant structure on the internet, what that does, I feel, is provide, it goes back to that idea of like validating other women's experiences for them.
I just want to get your comments on how money, political economy, impacts, you know, what stories are told around. Because as we find, mainstream publishers and even independent publishers groom only a few money earners, writers, and then the rest, writers of difference, disappear.
I have to say, I'm not going to reveal the names of a half a dozen young women I've taught, but they're all women from backgrounds which are not white privilege. In fact, they're definitely not white, and they've all got their own things, paid spaces now. And that is just fucking liberating for me to be able to see that there is a progression. If you're a person who has a paid space, you have a moral responsibility to talk about other voices and other experiences and other backgrounds than your own.
Hi, this is Scarlett, and you're listening to Broad on Joy 94.9.
Where I kind of wanted to begin is by talking about that question that you ask yourself when you're sitting down to write something. How much of myself do I put into this work?
I think there are two questions. How much of myself do I put in my writing, and why am I doing that? What is the purpose of my presence in the text? And sometimes the purpose is I can do with my experiences, with my own thinking, much more than I can do with anyone else's experiences. I can make jokes that are simply unforgivable if I were to make them about at someone else's expense, but I can certainly make them at my own expense. I can really push my sense of motivation, my exploration of identity. I can really go very far in terms of really interrogating myself, shaking myself up like a pear tree. So my presence is not necessarily a way not to engage in rigorous thinking, not to kind of deal with ideas, not to connect with other people's experiences. Sometimes it could be a way of doing that and doing it more effectively. I worry day and night about the self-indulgence, the latent narcissism, you know, what am I doing in my own work? And I think that kind of worrying is really productive. I don't want to all of a sudden wake up, and I know some, in particular some male authors who don't worry about it and who have a sense of absolute entitlement to the primacy of their experience and to the importance of their experience being articulated. I really like the fact that I'm torn to shreds sometimes, but that question, is it too much of me? I think it produces better writing because I keep questioning myself. You know, I make a decision. Sometimes putting myself in is the most risky thing I can do, and I think writing is about risk.
For me, the answer is probably really simple, and that's I can't write without myself. I got out of school and I thought that I was interested in becoming a journalist, and then I realised that I have real issue with the idea of objectivity, and maybe going and studying arts was a better idea. And in all of my writing, I feel as though I'm cheating if I don't acknowledge my subjectivity, if I don't put down on the page that I'm coming from a place of certain preconceptions, certain biases, certain education, certain thought processes, just certain history that I can't assume that the reader will share or even be aware of. And so for me, the idea of writing that is around the self is just a process of acknowledging subjectivity of the writer as well as potentially of the interview subject or of just the subject of the piece.
I'm interested in this idea of writing about yourself as being safe or unsafe. Actually, I know we started talking about essays, but it brought up something to mind for me. I actually finished my PhD a couple of years ago, and the topic that I wrote on at the time, and in fact I think still, was quite contentious. It was about the politics of white people writing about Aboriginal Australia. But I do sometimes think that there is a that we have a tendency to think, well, the only place that I can write from politically safely is my own. The only perspective that I can write from is my own. And I wonder what you guys think about that. Like, is there a fundamental problem if we feel like we always have to kind of stake out that territory and tell the reader this is where I am before we write?
Thank you, sisters. You've been listening to this Broad podcast here on Joy 94.9. Don't forget to tune in to us Monday nights at 9 p.m. on Joy for feminism in your ears.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.